I view this as an historic opportunity for Congress to act, for Congress to replace a system that is not working with one that we believe will work a lot better.
That's President Bush urging Congress to pass comprehensive immigration reform legislation yesterday, and the U.S. Senate did vote to revive the debate yesterday. We will talk about the state and fate of immigration legislation this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Wednesday, June the 27th, and we look forward to your participation in this conversation. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'll talk with a guest political analyst about the details of the plan and whether or not this bill will survive a final Senate vote. The Senate is going to be taking up 26 amendments as early as today that have the potential to either add or subtract supporters. And then the legislation must survive another make-or-break vote in the Senate as well. So, what do you want to see when it comes to immigration reform? Do you like what's in this current bill? Increased border security, but a pathway to citizenship for the already 12 million plus illegal immigrants already in the country, a guest worker program, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. What do you like and not like about the immigration legislation? Our guest is Dennis Riley, professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy.
So is this was this a surprise that the Senate had the 60 votes it needed to revive this debate yesterday?
Probably not a terribly big surprise, because I think there are so many people in the Senate that think this should be brought to a head and let's have a vote on it. The president wants it very badly, and that brought some Republicans over to the side of, okay, we'll consider it. But we're a long ways from getting it passed.
Yeah, I mean, what happened yesterday was, okay, we'll talk about it again, but it doesn't mean that those 64 people will vote for this particular legislation.
No, it certainly doesn't. And it doesn't even mean there will be a vote on the legislation. It just means that it's now okay to introduce all those amendments. And then if we clear the decks after the amendments, there will be one more vote on the question of whether the actual bill is going to be voted on, then there will be a vote on the bill itself. So we've got two more fairly significant votes to go, plus all those amendments to consider. And then when that's all done, there will either be an up and up or down vote on the bill itself as amended, or there won't be. It could still be stopped then.
And that's just the Senate.
That's just the Senate.
The House Republicans, holding a private conference last night, voted 114-23 to oppose the Senate measure.
Right. Mm-hmm. And there were a good many Republicans that weren't there for that vote. Obviously, they have more than 130 or whatever it was people. But it was pretty overwhelmingly against it. And there's another side, too. The president hasn't begun to lobby the House. It's got to get out of the Senate first. So there hasn't been any significant executive branch activity. But the issue is so hot in the House of Representatives. House members come from smaller, more homogenous districts. And if that issue is big in your district, it's big. Now it turns out that the labor movement is quite divided over the question. And so some liberal Democrats with strong labor support may feel pressure from some parts of organized labor to vote against it when it comes up in the House. Senators are less susceptible to that, not immune, but less susceptible. So it could go very funny ways in the House once it finally gets there.
Yeah. Do you expect it to get there?
Boy, this is a really hard one. I don't know what all the 26 amendments say. I know what probably about half of them say. And what you don't know is, will there be what you might call strategic voting? Will some people vote for amendments that they know will drive other people away from the final product? They want the bill to go down, so will they vote for amendments that will end up killing the bill when it comes to a final vote? There may be some of that. There may be some strange coalitions on certain amendments. And what will the final package look like? Will all of its current supporters be able to stay with it? presumably some of those amendments are simply going to be deal breakers for some of the people who support what's there now, slightly amended. So we'll have to see what comes out of all of that amendment package. I guess I have a hunch in the end that it's not going to make it, but that's just a hunch.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the current state without the amendments. What of this bill? Why don't you just give us the basic outline as to what this comprehensive immigration reform legislation contains?
Okay. Well, I'll do my best. It's got border security changes. It's going to try to, as some of its supporters say, seal the border with Mexico, and so it's got double fence for a whole bunch of miles. It's got what they call the virtual fence, where you have towers and surveillance cameras and instant communication to Border Patrol agents. It'll beef up the Border Patrol. It will do a whole lot of things that are basically aimed at making it extremely difficult for someone to cross that border between the United States and Mexico successfully. Now, that doesn't do much to stop those people who come into the country quite legally and then just stay. Mm-hmm. And there's a good many of them. And it doesn't do much about the people who come into the country legally from Eastern Europe and stay. But it meets some people's needs. So there's a border security part of the bill, and that's a crucial part for any Republican support, I would suspect. Mm-hmm. Then it's got some dramatic changes in worker status, that is, people who are here illegally. They call it a pathway to citizenship. It's a long path, and it's an expensive path, but it is there. The so-called Z visa, where a person in the country as of January 1, 2007, can go to the Department of Homeland Security, get certified, and then a year later, they can work during the interim, then starts a long process where they have to pay a fine, go home and apply for another Z visa that would last a lot longer. Then eventually, 10 or 15 years down the road, they might become U.S. citizens. At least they can get permanent resident status along the way. But there are other fines and other things they're going to have to propose.
And despite, though, this being a long path and fines and benchmarks and hoops, critics still say this is amnesty for lawbreakers.
Absolutely. And they will continue to say that because the word resonates with their constituencies. People think of it as just, oh, okay, we can't stop you guys, so we're just going to let you stay and, whatever. It, no matter how tortuous the path, I think you're exactly right. There are a set of people who are going to say, that's amnesty. Amnesty is bad. And other people are going to have to say, well, it's not really amnesty. Well, it's a qualified, and so we'll argue the semantics of it. But basically, you have a set of people who simply want those 12 million people found and deported. I mean, that would be the only thing that would actually satisfy them, and that's probably not going to happen. Then there's, of course, the guest worker program that doesn't get triggered right away because we have to deal with the Z visa thing first, but there's a scheduled guest worker program of maybe up to 500,000 people who could get temporary visas to come in and work for a year. They'd have to go home, then they could come back and work for 2 years, and they can come from anywhere in the world. That's not strictly Mexicans coming in to pick strawberries. It's high-tech people coming in for a year or two on contract to Microsoft. It's all kinds of folks, but it's a good-sized number. So there's a whole lot of job-oriented things in here that are aimed at the fact that many people feel that the economy depends on a set of people at the high end and the low end that we can't generate ourselves, that the American population simply can't fill these slots, high-end, high-tech slots and low-end physical labor slots. We can't fill them, so we're going to have to bring people in. Some of them are already here through the Z visa business. Some of them will come through the guest workers, but we have to handle that part of our economy. So we have that put into it. And then there's a long-term change in immigration philosophy, a shift which will no longer focus exclusively on family reunification. That's the primary philosophy of immigration, legal immigration now. If a legal immigrant is here or a naturalized citizen is here and has family somewhere else, those people get priority. that there's a huge backlog among those people, but they get priority. Well, this bill would try to clear the backlog, but then it splits that set of visas between family reunification and high-skilled workers that we can't seem to generate for ourselves.
We are talking with Dennis Riley, professor of political science at UW-Stevens Point, looking at the current state and the fate of immigration legislation that's in the U.S. Senate right now. Yesterday, the Senate did vote to revive the debate on this legislation, and the Senate is slated to consider now 26 amendments that have the potential to perhaps add or subtract support from the current legislation, and then it must survive another make-or-break vote in the Senate as early as tomorrow. If it passes the Senate, it still faces a very tough future in the House of Representatives. We are wondering if you want to see this immigration legislation pass Congress or not. What changes would you like to see in the legislation, if any? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up, Kathleen Dunn is with you between 9 and 11. After 10, Kathleen Dunn's guest says there are many lessons to be learned from the Vietnam era that could apply today. Editor of the book Iraq and the Lessons of Vietnam, or How Not to Learn from the Past, joins Kathleen after 10 o'clock this morning. We're talking about the immigration debate that's front and center before Congress, the Senate taking it up, yesterday voting to revive the debate, and we're going to be considering a bunch of amendments now to this comprehensive immigration reform legislation that President Bush is backing, and so is Democratic Senator Kennedy. Talk some with our guest about the odd politics of this particular piece of legislation, and we wonder what questions you have, what concerns you have, what you think of this legislation, whether you want Congress to pass this bill or something like it or not. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Let me go to the phones and take our first caller, Gino in Milwaukee. Hi, Gino.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Morning.
I simply wanted to make a comment on the proposed legislation in that I am an immigrant myself, of course, and the Z visa program may actually do more harm than good. And in my opinion, it may actually be attrition in disguise because a lot of immigrants are simply not going to trust that the government will just give them paperwork so they can leave the country and then return without problems. And I was just wondering if the professor could comment on that.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Professor Riley?
Well, there isn't any question that Gino has a very good point in the sense that for an awful lot of the people who are in the United States illegally, even stepping that far forward to go to an office run by something called the Department of Homeland Security and say, here I am, and I came in illegally, or I came in legally, but I stayed illegally, whatever it is, to come and say that and say, give me the paperwork that will allow me to get on this long path, and then say, yes, I agree that somewhere along the line I'll take just these pieces of paper in my hands, and I'll go home to Mexico, I'll go home to Guatemala, I'll go home to Nicaragua, and I'll stand in another line and fill out another piece of paper, and then I'll come back. He's right. Psychologically, a lot of folks are just simply going to say, I don't want to do that. I can't do that. I'm afraid to go back there, or it's just more trouble than it's worth. I've got a steady job, and I'm going to stay with that steady job, and we'll see if the enforcement of the new law is able to catch up with me eventually. So I think he's right. There'll be some difficulty. Some people will come forward, and I don't think it's completely impossible to make it work, but he's right. It's going to be a lot more difficult than it sounds to get people to step forward and take that chance. These are not people that necessarily trust governments in general. They didn't trust their governments at home. They don't trust their government here.
Yeah. You had mentioned a little earlier that labor is very divided over this legislation. What's the divide?
Well, see, I've got it right here someplace. But it basically, the Service Employees Union is very much interested in pushing this legislation through. The AFL-CIO, the big parent umbrella, is very much opposed to seeing this legislation go through. The Teamsters don't want it to go through. Other unions do. So it's not an even split. There are three or four large unions that want it, and a number of other unions, including their umbrella organization, the AFL-CIO, which doesn't have the power it once had by any means. They're opposed to it. They think it's going to bring in unskilled labor that will drive down wages. They think they're going to lose some of the benefits they used to have. It's kind of classic union response to a new set of potential competitors for certain kinds of jobs. Now, for the most part, the jobs that we think of are not unionized jobs anymore, but construction sites still have some considerable union presence, and there's an increasing undocumented worker presence in the construction industry, and it's a non-union presence, and so they're pretty worried about that. So it's back and forth. You know, those unions that see it as in their interest to have many of their current workers, you know, all of a sudden become legal, they'd love to see that, versus some unions who are afraid that this is going to put downward pressure on wages, and then some unions who are thinking that, you know, this is going to create a class of exploited workers, and that's never a good thing for the American worker to have a group of exploited workers in the same country.
Next, we go to Carolyn in Milwaukee. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi. I think you just touched on my concern. I heard, and I haven't actually read the bill or anything, but I heard that the employers would have some power over whether a person could stay while they waited. And I'm concerned about protection of the workers when they come in, that they're not abused or made to work off the clock. And because George Bush is pushing this, it makes me concerned that this might be an attack on the workers, on the unions.
Well, those are really serious concerns because essentially what you have to have in the Z visa business eventually is an employer that says, yes, I need this person. That is to say, I can't get an American citizen to do this job. I want this person, and I need to hold on to this person for a period of time. That's not going to be a major problem if you're working for Bill Gates. He'll make sure that that happens. If you're a high-tech individual that came in from India or Pakistan or Indonesia or Ireland, for heaven's sake, I mean, you know, wherever. But if you are doing day labor, you know, if you're working for a small construction company, I don't know. Do they really need to keep you as opposed to anybody else? So the fact that employers will have a say over whether you get this Z visa and can extend it, you've got to have a job to extend it, that could put them in a position where they have a considerable amount of leverage. But the leverage that they already have over undocumented workers is pretty substantial because those, you know, where does an undocumented worker go to complain about unsanitary conditions? Where do they go to complain about not being paid overtime? I mean, to complain, you've got to come, as they say, out of the shadows. You've got to come all the way out and take a chance that you won't get nailed for being an undocumented worker. So it may not be so much different than the position so many such folks are in right now, except they might have a government agency they could complain to, but maybe not.
A similar thought from Dave in Madison in an email. He says, the bottom line in this immigration bill is the guest worker program, which is just another form of quasi-slavery on which this country has been built. It also weakens labor unions and destroys good-paying jobs. That's why Bush, many Republicans, and business leaders so desperately want this current bill passed. Your reaction?
Well, you know, you've got two very different sets of business leaders that want this passed. You've got the high-tech people. They have no intention of exploiting anybody. They just want some of the best software engineers and other kinds of technological wizards to come work in the United States for a while, even if it's just 2 or 3 years, project-specific kinds of things. They want to drive the next generation of technological innovation, want to drive it from here, and don't believe that America is producing the necessary people. So that, you know, the Bill Gates side of it is not interested in exploitation in any serious way. But the meatpacking industry, I'm not quite so willing to give a pass to. They're interested in people who will do dangerous, repetitive, unpleasant work for long hours and kind of minimal pay. They would really love to be able to bring those folks in as guest workers. I was a kid raised in an agricultural valley in California. I know what it means to bring in Mexicans and exploit them on a daily basis. I watched it. I picked fruit alongside them in the fields while I was in high school, and it was a pretty interesting thing, being one of the only white folks out there. I didn't last very long because I couldn't compete, but I did work part of a summer. I know what it means to watch that, and it is pretty scary. I'm not sure about Dave's point about destroying high-paying jobs, because I don't think the bulk of the folks, except on the high-tech side of the economy, are going to be coming in and taking any high-paid jobs. I don't know if any of the jobs that are high-paying now are going to be shifted over to this. Maybe. You know, that would be an interesting thing. In some sense, I've got to backtrack a bit. At one time, working in a unionized meatpacking plant paid pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
And now you can't find a unionized meatpacking plant to work in. They just keep getting shut down. How long was that strike in Wisconsin?
Yeah, I can't remember. But then you do hear stories, though, which I don't know how much they're paying per hour in a meatpacking plant. Nobody could pay me enough to do that. But when there was some sort of sweep of illegal workers some time back, a bunch of Americans who were legal lined up to take these jobs, is what we hear, that these are jobs that that Americans will take.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's always a hard question. Are they jobs Americans won't take, or jobs that Americans won't take at the wages that other Americans want to pay? Some of it's that they don't pay enough. There are some things that people just don't want to do. But when I think of, you know, what I won't do, yeah, I'm not going to go into a meatpacking plant and do that. I don't know what I'll do, but I won't do that. On the other hand, I shouldn't speak for other Americans who might be willing to do that, because they can't seem to find anything else. They might not want to do it for long, but they might do it for a while. So it's always hard to generalize, you know, from what you feel to what large numbers of other people might feel. So I don't know. Maybe some high-paying jobs are being destroyed, but I find that argument a little more tenuous than most of the others.
Yeah. Let's go to George in Milwaukee. Hi, George.
Hi. Yeah, just to kind of pick up on that, because it's kind of the point that I was going to make. It's not so much that Americans won't do the jobs. It's just that Americans won't do the jobs for the pay that the immigrants receive, the illegal immigrants receive. And if employers paid these people or paid a higher wage, you know, how many stories do we see about, you know, good paying, family supporting jobs in the United States when there are, when there's a factory perhaps that opens, you know, it's inundated with thousands upon thousands of people who are vying for the 100 or 200 jobs that are there. This happens time and time again. It's not that Americans won't work. It's just that they're not going to work for what they consider to be starvation wages. And I think that we all have some responsibility in this also, because I don't think it's the employers that should bear 100% of the responsibility in order to provide them with that higher wage. I think we all have to realize that if we want to solve this problem, which may be somewhat, which is related to our own unemployment situation in the United States, which doesn't get talked about very much anymore, which is a lot higher than the official numbers would suggest, I think that we have to, as consumers, be willing to pay more money for what we're going to be eating or what we're going to be consuming, and think of it as, in some sense, an aspect of fairness that we are allowing people who work in these menial jobs to get a living wage.
Professor Riley?
Well, that's an excellent point, and it's something that Americans don't particularly want to confront, but eventually we're going to have to. If we want high-paying jobs that essentially are not the high-skilled jobs that we always think of as paying fairly well, then we're going to have to pay for it. And basically what I think a lot of people are beginning to suggest is that, look, we've tried redistributing income through the tax-based system. Now we're going in the opposite direction on that, but we've tried it, and maybe that's not the way to do it. Maybe we need to redistribute income from those who have a lot to those who have a lot less by paying those who have a lot less more, and that means we all got to pay more for everything that we purchase if we want to sustain those kinds of jobs. We could make Nikes in Portland, Oregon, the way the first ones were made, Beaverton, actually, but we're not going to, because nobody feels they want to pay for that much for a shoe. And it kind of becomes a circle. I can't afford to pay that much for a shoe. Why? Because you don't pay me enough for what I do to be able to pay that much for a shoe. How does anybody break that cycle and say, all right, we're going to start paying people at the bottom end a whole lot more, and we're not going to do it by just taxing those at the upper end. We're going to make everybody pay more. I don't know. I'm not sure any politician is willing to make that proposal and say this is where we really want to go. So it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. But George makes an excellent point that consumers are going to have to bear the burden if that's going to happen.
Yeah, I know, Professor Riley, you don't know specifically all 26 amendments that the Senate is going to be considering today, tomorrow, but I mean, are these amendments going to be altering any of these aspects of the bill to some extent that would make them more, I don't know, palatable or even worse?
I'm sure that there's going to be some that are going to go either way. That is, there will be some amendments being offered that are going to make the quote border security parts of it much tougher.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what does that mean? A longer fence, a thicker fence,
right?
More than 28,000 new Border Patrol agents, but 40,000 new Border Patrol agents. It's real hard to say. Some people are going to propose things along that line. Some are going to want to eliminate the guest worker program. Let's just take that right out of the bill. Well, that's not coming out of the bill, or the bill's not going to make it. That's too important to the president. It's too important to too many constituencies that have a great deal of clout. So that'll stay in. But somebody's probably going to amend it to take it out, or to cut it in half, or whatever. So there'll be all those kinds of proposals. I think on a lighter note, maybe, one of the amendments that's made it into the Republican package is a very narrowly framed amendment that's basically to protect Home Depot from the city of Los Angeles.
I saw that on the... Yeah.
Did you see that? Isn't that great? The Senate is an interesting place, just like the House is an interesting place. The guy's going to vote. Isaacson, the senator who introduced it, Home Depot being based in Atlanta, has said he's going to vote against the final bill.
Yeah, the Home Depot was complaining that the city was telling it to have accommodations for the migrant workers.
Right. What they would have to have is appropriate shelter. The expectation is that there would be something with a roof, because it gets kind of warm in Los Angeles sometimes. This is all aimed at 13 new Home Depot stores in Los Angeles, because the Home Depot stores on the suburbs of Los Angeles have basically become places where immigrants, legal and illegal, even United States citizens, congregate every morning, and small contractors come through, buy the materials inside, walk out, say you, and you, get in the truck, and they go to a construction site, and they do some work. So these have become kind of informal, non-union hiring halls for low-skilled workers, and Home Depot just lets them mill around in the parking lot. And what City of Los Angeles says is, no, you're going to have a place where they can get out of the sun, you're going to have a place where they can get a drink of water, and you're going to have a place where they can go to the bathroom. And you're going to pay for that. And it's going to be around the side of the building someplace. And, there's quite a battle going on, and now Isaacson has introduced this amendment. So the amendments will range from that to amendments that will basically try to take out major portions, adjust the Z visa program so that you have to go back to your home country, and under the current proposal, you go back there, you fill out the forms, you file the forms with the United States consulate or whatever it is, then you can come back to the country legally and go back to work while all the processing goes on. Well, somebody might want to amend it to say, no, you go back and you stay back until you get cleared, because that will drastically reduce the number of people who are able to come back.
I got an email from Al in Milwaukee who says, what I would like to see in the bill is a constitutional amendment on automatic citizenship. People should no longer acquire citizenship automatically just by being born in this country. It should be a requirement that at least one parent be a citizen. Ask your guest how many illegals come here, have a child, and then get legality through family reunion. Do you know?
Do I have a number or
no.
percentage? No, I certainly don't. Does it happen? Sure. Now, you can't stick a constitutional amendment in the middle of a Senate bill, so that would have to be a completely separate enterprise, which would go through a completely separate process through the Senate Judiciary Committee and a House Judiciary Committee and have to be ratified by the states and so on. So I don't see that happening necessarily. Obviously, it's going to happen. Somewhere along the line, people have come into the United States and born children. They came in, women came in pregnant, and they had a child.
Mm-hmm.
Under our citizenship laws, rules, et cetera, that's a U.S. citizen. How many then ultimately get reunited? A percentage, because we do have that family reunification business, but I don't think all of them do by any stretch. And where we sit now is a backlog. I've lost the number here. It's in these notes somewhere. But we have a backlog that they think will take 8 years to clear out.
We're talking with Dennis Riley, professor of political science at UW-Stevens Point, about the immigration legislation that's before the U.S. Senate this week. Yesterday, the Senate voted to revive the legislation. Now it's going to be considering a whole bunch of amendments to the legislation before taking a vote on the entire thing again, perhaps as early as tomorrow. Do you want to see this legislation pass? What do you like or not like about it? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Stay with us coming up. After a decade as Britain's Prime Minister, Tony Blair is standing down amid much speculation concerning his political future. After 9, Kathleen Dunn and her guest will discuss Blair's career, the Labour Party, and how the Iraq War affected his leadership. That's coming up in our next hour. We're talking about the immigration reform debate with Dennis Riley, professor of political science at UW-Stevens Point. And our next caller is Dan in Middleton. Hi, Dan. You're on the air.
Yes, thanks for the show. I have a unique perspective, or not unique, I guess. I am married to an immigrant. We went through the process. She came to college here, got a job, got an H-1 visa, and I met her at work, and eventually she's a permanent resident currently. But her process, I think the main point about the new visa bill is the skills that are required. I know a lot of people talk about the family component, but I think it's very important to keep the skill component to it, because that is the main thing. We're looking for skilled workers. I feel that if they imposed more employee sanctions and held the employers, or employer sanctions, held the employers accountable, we'd get we'd have fewer immigrants, fewer illegal immigrants. I mean, I'm all for immigration. It's just the process. If I wanted to apply for a permanent resident in Canada, Australia, you go to any of these websites and there's a test you take. You have to have, you know, you get more points for a 4-year college degree. You get more points for this, more points for that. And I'm not saying that they should, you know, not be able to bring families in, but I think the main point is having skilled ones. And then the comment about the children being born here are citizens, they have to become 18 in order to apply for their parents to come or anything like that. So it's not like, oh, they're born and a 2-year-old can sponsor the parents. You can't do that. There's a lot of policies like that. So yeah. I guess I could take your comment off the air.
Thanks very much. Professor Riley?
Okay, that last point's an interesting one. I didn't know that. I suspected it, but I didn't know it. And that would mm-hmm. certainly make a huge difference to the complaint that Al was making a minute ago, or made in his mm-hmm. email, rather. But the skills side of it, the point system that will become the focal point of immigration policy once we clear the backlog based on family ties, does include those kinds of things. And it is interesting because it's a point system, and it would be based on job skills, education, English proficiency, employment history, and that sort of thing. And we are certainly interested in such people. We want to increase the number of individuals with high skills, English proficiency, and the like. But we also, whether we like it or not, we do also have that set of jobs. Yes, Americans will do them maybe if you pay them enough, but we don't want to pay that much for those jobs because we want to keep our prices where they are, our standard of living what it is. We don't really want to share the wealth quite that much. So we do have a set of jobs that we want to fill with people who are not United States citizens, and they don't require the kinds of skills that are being talked about. Indeed, they may not even require English proficiency in many instances. You know, we hired a Latin American politics specialist who's coming into our department. Her husband is from Argentina. He's a builder, renovator of old houses, mm-hmm. and he did some interim work, and he said he wanted to go practice his English skills and discovered he couldn't speak English for 8 hours a day. Because the only way he could communicate with his crews was in his native Spanish. So they don't even necessarily need English proficiency skills because even their people that are telling them what to do are mm-hmm. speaking to them in their own language, in their native language. So, yeah, we have that set of jobs, and we have to come to grips with the fact that the sets of jobs that we want to fill are fundamentally different. They're at different ends of the pay scale, different ends of the social scale. And we have to come to grips with that and figure out how to balance our immigration policy so that we fill both sets, or go as one of our callers, and I've forgotten exactly who, said, go ahead, let the consumers pay what it really costs to make this stuff if it was made by our standards, by our folks living with a decent wage and having health benefits.
Thank you, Dan. Joel in Germantown is with us now. Hi, Joel.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
My question is, how does the government plan to pay for the entitlement obligations for millions of more citizens?
I don't know. Do you, Professor Riley?
Well, there's only one way to pay for entitlement obligations, and that's to pay for it through tax revenues raised by some level of government or other. I mean, at the national level, we pay for a lot of things by borrowing it, but presumably we'll pay it back. The state can't borrow very much. The local governments can't borrow very much to do those kinds of things. So those, to the extent that they're created, they're going to have to be funded out of taxpayer funds. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah. And isn't there some sort of estimate on what this would initially cost? I'm looking for it, but I don't find.
Yeah, I don't.
I'll look for it as we go.
Okay,
along.
I don't see it in my stuff either. But it's got to be a substantial sum of money. I mean, just creating the new security system on the border is going to cost a great deal of money, because you're talking about doubling the size of the Border Patrol. So when you talk about 14, 15,000 new Border Patrol agents and all the support, the wages, the benefits, but all the support, you got to buy them the vehicles they need. You have to buy them a variety of, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, that's going to cost a lot of money. The fence construction is going to cost a good bit of money. The virtual fence, that's a big contract with Boeing at the moment. They're experimenting with a 28-mile stretch. And so all of that's going to be expensive, and that doesn't count processing all of the Z visa applications, speeding the processing of the family reunification applications. I mean, yeah, this is going to be a very expensive project.
Next we go to Ron in Gordon. Hi, Ron.
Hi. Yeah, I have a question. We say illegal immigrants are now working for substandard wages under substandard conditions. What is it going to be their incentive to continue to do this once they become legal?
Well, I don't know. I imagine some of the same incentives that were in existence for immigrants that were legal, illegal, or that nobody cared one way or the other a century ago. That is, they want to eat. They want to pay for their families. So they work in substandard conditions and for substandard wages. I mean, the novel by Upton Sinclair that blew the whistle on the meatpacking industry. It was the meatpacking industry in Chicago at the turn of the 20th century, not the meatpacking industry in Alabama in the turn of the 21st. So there have always been people who, desperate enough for money, would work in substandard conditions for substandard wages.
Yeah, Ron, I think, is wondering if the immigrants are legal, mm-hmm. maybe they'll seek out a better, higher paying job and not settle for that.
That might be, and if that happens, I think that's a terrific thing, mm-hmm. because it means that the whole system kind of is moving up. I was suggesting was those were perfectly legal Polish, Czech, Slovak immigrants
right.
in Chicago that worked under those conditions. The assumption has always been when you get to the United States, you may suffer, but your children will be better off.
Yeah. Well, we talked a little bit about why President Bush is supporting this legislation. Why are Democrats or Ted Kennedy, a supporter of labor issues like these, supporting this legislation?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Ted Kennedy may have a number of things in mind, not the least of which might be part of the Kennedy legislative legacy. He's in his 70s. He's not ready to quit, but he knows that there is a time limit to how long Ted Kennedy is a major figure. A lot of Democrats have the union constituency, but they also have a Mexican-American constituency that votes. They have other, the Democratic coalition has a number of different minority groups who take a real interest in immigration because they're the legalized wave now, but, they take a real interest in it. Or maybe they were born here, but they still take a real interest in it. So there's a natural constituency, and the Democrats, and to some extent, at least according to his talk of 7 years ago, the president and the Republican Party want to compete for the mm-hmm. growing Hispanic constituency. So some of it is that kind of identity politics that every group goes through as it begins to reach legitimate status in the United States, as Mexican Americans and other Hispanics certainly have. So there's those sorts of things. And, maybe it's just a humane and decent thing to do in Ted Kennedy's eyes. That, this is just something that I probably ought to do this. We ought to move in some direction. This just doesn't work.
Yeah, I know that Senators Feingold and Cole voted with the majority yesterday in reviving the debate, but I guess I don't know if they've got strong, positions one way or another on the legislation. Do you happen to know offhand?
I really don't. Mm-hmm. I don't think I've heard that much mm-hmm. out of either one of them. We would have had this gone through normal channels because it would have gone through the Judiciary Committee and they would have had a shot at it,
mm-hmm.
but it didn't. It was kind of a behind-the-scenes discussion among certain key senators and leaders and representatives of the executive branch and so on. So it didn't go through channels, so they haven't had a chance to speak to it. And I don't know that either one has grabbed an opportunity, although certainly an awful lot of senators have.
Well, this is a real hot potato, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no doubt about it.
Kathy in New Auburn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I'm responding to a few of the comments that have been made. Personally, I think the immigration thing is, the discussion has been pretty mean-spirited in terms of how it's phrased. I think it's pitting American workers against migrant workers, and the idea that the consumer is at fault is another misleading thing. It's a diversionary tactic. The shareholders, the stockholders who want more profit. Jobs are moved overseas because not because some business isn't making a profit, but they can make more profit. Garments and shoes are made for pennies and sold for hundreds of dollars, but yet the consumer is blamed, and the worker is told here that we should take less money for our labor because, otherwise it's going to go elsewhere. And I just think it's a circuitous argument that leaves out a very important part of the pie in terms of who's making the decisions and what the effect is.
All right. Anything there,
Professor? Oh, that's an excellent point. And certainly if I suggested that, consumers are exclusively to blame, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to do that. But I think that American business leaders, certainly profit drives their decisions. But they're assuming, I think, that we don't want to pay certain levels for certain kinds of things. We just won't pay it. Consequently, if they try to supply it at that level, they won't be able to be successful. Now, that doesn't excuse their greed in trying to get even more than they perhaps should be getting. But I think consumers can't escape the blame completely and have to be given at least a certain level of it. I would give the business leaders a greater level than it might have sounded like earlier. But, you know, who drives the consumer economy, the consumer or the advertiser or the producer? We're all in it together, and we all take a certain amount of blame for it.
Yeah, and I thought that Kathy meant the discussion in general, not this particular hour. But I know
there's a certain truth to that too.
Bob in Milwaukee, hi, you're on the air.
Hey, good morning. Just a quick comment. You know, it strikes me as interesting. Companies obviously want to arbitrage the labor market, so the general assumption there is that labor is not mobile, but capital is. So you move the capital to the labor. But in this case, in the case of Mexico and Canada, clearly the labor is mobile, and it wants to be here, which raises the dirty little secret, which is we don't really want the labor to move. We just want to be able to move the capital. And that brings me to the question. Why is it that it's, you know, we got NAFTA in place, we want openness, we want lack of trade barriers and all those other externalities, but what we don't want is we want the chicken to come across the border without any taxes or barriers or inspections, but we don't want the guy who cleans the chicken to be able to come over the border. I don't get it.
I like that. Mm-hmm. But we also have to remember that a certain amount of the labor that we want to slip across the border one way or other, that labor has to be applied in specific places. You can't move construction to where it's cheaper. If you want to build a luxury house here in Stevens Point, Wisconsin, you got to build it here in Stevens Point, Wisconsin. You got to bring the folks who build it here. You can't take your $500,000 and go there. So some labor is place-specific. Nannies are place-specific. You live somewhere and you want someone to take care of your kids while you go to work. Cleaning personnel are place-specific. Yeah, you could move the chicken processing plant down into Mexico and bring the chicken across for nothing, but not the person who serves that chicken to you on a fancy plate. So we have a whole lot of stuff that is place-specific. We often call it the service industry. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't. But some of it is, and therefore we feel we have to bring some people across who will do that really cheap.
Yeah. Well, another informative hour, and we appreciate it. Thank you very much, Dennis Riley.
Well, thank you, Joy.
Dennis Riley, professor of political science at UW Stevens Point, talking with us about the immigration legislation that the Senate is hammering out this week, and we'll continue following this issue as it moves through Congress, if it moves through Congress. Thanks to Leo Duran for producing this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network.